This is part of a series that we've been presenting on the future of the Earth, and some of the others have kind of pointed out that the creation faces some kind of unique and serious challenges at the moment, but that the Church, I'd say particularly the Lutheran Church, has the potential for making a major contribution. We have the idea that on Good Friday, God did something that we couldn't do for ourselves, namely provided a means of reconciliation, and that we're not left with the task of trying to earn our salvation or earn some kind of a reconciliation with God, but that's given as a free gift of God. Now, if you have faith, and if you believe and you accept that reconciliation, it leaves you with a whole lifetime that you might wonder what you're to do, because you're not left with the task of trying to earn your salvation, so what do you do? And that, I think, is the essence of how Christians can make a real contribution to the future of the creation. Because I think the basic task that we have is to devote our lives to the redemption of the creation. That's not just other individuals, but it's putting the whole system right. It's thinking about how do you find a way of making a just banking system? How do you bring justice to the world? How do we protect and maintain the life support systems of the planet? That's what it is all about. So what I wanted to do today is to talk about what a parish might be like that had that view of things. And in a significant kind of way, I think it comes down to an interpretation of what you might call stewardship. And yesterday, Rudy Edmund gave me one of the very last copies of a booklet that he prepared for the, it was published by Augsburg Publishing House, called Sharing God's Gifts. And I'd like to read just two sentences from the introduction here, which he says, most of us have grown up with the notion that a good steward is one who contributes time, talent, and 10% or more of his or her income to the support of the Church and its charitable programs. But, he says, stewardship really relates to how we use the 90% of our money that we keep, how we earn our money, and to what extent everything we do is in keeping with God's intentions for all creation. And that's what he writes his book about. And I think that's really right. And what would a creation or what would a parish be like if it was devoted to something of that sort? I think there would still be preaching and teaching and classes and courses that would emphasize and make clear the story, if you would, the story of how we came to be and the nature of evil, the importance of Good Friday, and how we live with sins forgiven. But there'd be something much more that currently I find not very prevalent in my parish, and that would be that the parish would have a central mission. It would be a clear understanding that there was one purpose for the parish, and that would be that the parish is to help each and every member of the parish to take an active and constructive role in the redemption of the creation, the whole big job, and that a lot of time would be spent not just on a Bible study, but on study of the creation itself and understanding how it works and how it doesn't work and where injustice appears in it and how that injustice takes place. What are the systems that perpetuate it? All of that kind of thing. And a kind of central part of the task of the that would come out of that central mission is to help every single person to think about what their calling is. What is God asking them to do with the particular talents that that they have? Now, I've occasionally heard a pastor say that you can tell a person's values by looking at their checkbook, see where they spend their money. And I think usually what they have in mind is to add up all the checks that are made out to the church and see if it's 10% of the total. Now, Rudy's book and my way of thinking is that that's not really how you tell. That's something to look at. It's one indicator. But you want to look at how all the other checks, what's being done with those as well. And I think even more important, you want to look at the deposits. You want to find out what people are doing with their lives between Sundays, how they earn their income, what they're doing with their life. And think about, or have them thinking about, what is my calling? What should I be doing? Now, we need carpenters. We need bricklayers. We need accountants. We need all kinds of people. But we should have each and every member of our parishes making choices of vocation so that they're doing the thing that they feel, they understand, is what God is calling them to do with their life. And it shouldn't simply be a matter of being left to the vocational counselor in the high school, but it's something that the church should be actively involved in talking with people about, asking, are you doing what God wants you to do? There are, in my experience, a very high percentage of the people in my parish and in people that I'm acquainted with through my work that know full well that they're not doing what God would like them to do. That's not their calling. But they feel tied into that in some way that it's very hard for them to get out of it. So that's kind of a broad sense of what I would think a parish of the future might be about. And so I'd like to come into a few more specifics about how you would go about doing this. I think one of the major departures that I'd see between most parishes that I've had experience with to date and the kind of parish that I'm thinking about for the future would be that there'd be a whole lot less emphasis on prayer. Prayer, as it's practiced now, is a way in which we bring all kinds of petty petitions to God. God, I wish that guy that I work with would be a little bit more understanding. Or it's all kinds of little petty things. And instead of so much emphasis on prayer, which is us asking God for the most part, I'd say there needs to be a reawakening of a practice that was very strong in the early years of Christianity, and that is of meditation. It's listening. It's listening to what God has to say to us in our circumstance. It's taking a particularly important passage of Scripture and tuning everything out and sitting there and really thinking about what that means in the current situation, what it means to me, what it means to my family, my parish. It's trying to hear God. Now, that's a skill, it's a practice, it's an art, it's a discipline that's almost totally gone out of Christianity, but I think it's really important. It's important particularly when you think about this question of calling and vocation, where people need to be challenged to to think about what is it that God wants you to do with your life. In our own parish, we have a forum in which there's a lot of encouragement for people to come and talk about how their faith relates to what they do between Sundays. And we've had some really interesting sessions there. In one of these sessions, I talked about meditation and the importance of meditation and thinking seriously about what are you going to use your life for? If your sins are forgiven, you know, what now? What are you going to do? Is it just a matter of going out and having fun? I think there's more to it than that. And I explained the importance of meditation as a way of listening, hearing what God has in mind for it, and interpreting the experience that we have with others. You know, you get some insight into God's will for you as a result of what you're hearing from others, too, from other parts of the body of Christ. And at the end of that session, one of the people that had been in the forum for a long time said in a very quiet voice, "I don't think I want to meditate, because I'm not sure I would like to hear what God has to say." Now, and I thought it was a very candid kind of answer. It's a lot more fun. It's a lot less threatening and demanding in a way to not ask those questions and not listen. The president of a parish that I was involved with for a while had a choice of merging with another parish. That they were both very tiny little places, and neither one of them doing very well. And my parish finally decided not to. They voted against coming into it. But the president of the parish and I were talking on the phone just before the vote, and I remarked that there seemed to be a lot of prayer going on by the members of the parish. And she said, "Yes, there was a lot of prayer going on." And in effect, the people were praying in a way that said, "Shut up, God, I'm praying. I don't want to hear what you're saying." And prayer can be a way of simply not listening, and it shouldn't be. Well, I think another important part of a parish of the future would be a great deal more emphasis on the history of the parish. If the parish can have an understanding of its central project, the redemption of the creation, then an important thing to do would be to begin to build up a history of understanding of how that has happened, how you've made efforts in this direction. And I think you wouldn't necessarily be building a history of saints in the way in which the Catholic Church has, but you should build up, it'd be great to build up a series of role models, a story, you know, in the sense of our story, the whole story of creation and redemption. It'd be nice to have a story like that for a parish, a small-scale version. And in it, I think there would be some heroes and heroines that would stand out. The Abrahams and the Sarahs and so forth. People who have done things that may have been simple, small things at the time, but that in retrospect helped establish a direction for the parish that really made a significant difference. In our parish, there's one person that I will always remember, but I don't think very many other people in the parish do remember. This was a deputy sheriff who really was an honest man and took his job very seriously. And he went to work one day, and as he was going into the front steps of the county courthouse, he found the sheriff bringing in 8 prisoners who had a lot of mud on them, and on their pants legs, and cement on their shirts. And this is a very unusual thing to find prisoners outside the jail, and let alone in that condition. Well, it turned out the sheriff had been making a regular practice of taking prisoners out of the jail and putting them to work on construction projects that he was getting paid for. Well, the deputy got fired because he saw the sheriff doing something illegal, grossly illegal. And the deputy was unemployed for quite a while. He ran for sheriff. And the machine of which the sheriff was a part beat him. But there was a person who was out in the world between Sundays really trying to make a difference in his own small way. He knew he could be an effective deputy sheriff. He knew he could be an effective sheriff. And he was out there trying. And he got rejected. You know, the principalities and the powers defeated that man. But there was a man who really tried. Another person that I continue to think very highly of in the way in which she goes out and really tries is a woman whose husband left her. And left her with a young girl, daughter, and she is now making her income in a medical practice in which she works with a doctor, and she administers chemotherapy to young adolescents who have cancer. Many of her patients die, and it's a traumatic thing to be working day after day with young people who look like they've got promising futures and who have cancer, and many of them are going to die, and to see some of them die, and see also that every time they come to see her, she makes them sick. The drugs she gives them makes them very, very sick. And in fact, many of them develop a response similar to the one that Pavlov discovered with the dogs, in that the minute they walk into her office, they retch. Just to look at her makes them retch. You know, that's a tough job. But she stays at it, and she is just a wonderful, supportive person in a lot of ways. Now, it's people like that that I think a parish needs to understand and tell the story of those people and why they're doing the things they do. Because out of that, you can get a sense of what it means to live a life that's devoted to the redemption of the creation. There are other people doing other things that need to be remembered. But it's examples like that. Now, another thing that I think a parish could do a great job of in the future is working with the young people. In my experience, there's a youth program, and you get people through the confirmation process and First Communion. And then it's kind of an end at that point. They may go off to college or something like that. They're done. You know, you've prepared them in a way. And it seems to me that that's the very place where things should begin. You know, getting through confirmation, getting to the point where you understand your sins are forgiven, that's kind of like getting through kindergarten, in my view of things. And then you need to go much further. It's at that point where people are just beginning to think about, what do I do with my life? Now, if there could be some kind of a program in which the adults of the parish would take each of these young people and say, Come on and spend a day with me and I'll show you what I do. You know, I'm trying to live my life in such a way that I'm a part of the redemptive process of the creation. Now come and I'll show you what I do. And let's talk about what you think you can do. Now, there would be a really interesting way to go on and to make very clear to the young people that you think that that choice of vocation is important and that God's got a real interest in it. That could be really very beneficial. Out of it, it might be possible, eventually, to get a different group of people going to seminaries. You know, when high school kids take these SAT tests, I don't think it's the top 10% of the people in those SAT scores that go to the seminaries. And it would be wonderful if we had a group of clergy who were among the best and the brightest, who were really very, very capable people, and who studied some things beyond just theology, but thought about the whole of the creation as well as just the theological studies. That could be really wonderful. But in any event, each and every person that comes out as a parish, we need to be thinking about what do you do with these people? What choice should they be making? And I think it would be wonderful and appropriate if that in some way we could create a sacrament, maybe you'd call it, but at least some kind of formal recognition of people having made a choice of vocation. And that they come and speak before the congregation at a worship service and say, I've decided I'm going to do this, and this is why I've decided to do it. And this is how I feel it fits into the whole process of redeeming the creation. Now, that would make something much more significant out of that choice of vocation, and it would make very clear that that's an important part. So those are some kind of major directions, things that I think are important. I can think of some other specifics, but I've talked about a half an hour. So why don't I stop there and see what ideas you've got about your current parish or what you'd like to see in the future.
Well, yeah. Maybe to start at the beginning where you did. For a long time, for all my life, I thought of prayer as what I put out to God. And being a real expressive person, that fit quite well. However, I didn't get a lot of satisfaction out of that because somehow I didn't feel like I was giving anything back, and that's when I started to examine it a little more. And I honestly believe that prayer is exactly what you describe meditation as being. The truest form of prayer is really us listening.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I think meditation is sort of an inflammatory word to a lot of Christians because they do associate it with Eastern thought, which has some negative connotations, or with certain groups and cults of people that use that as their only form of worship. So I would just like to put forth the idea that we don't need less emphasis on prayer, we need more emphasis on prayer as listening. And as an opening rather than putting out.
Okay.
Also in our church, we have what we call a prayer fellowship. And I do think that prayer concerns that are shared among people can bring them together in a kind of fellowship together. Some people would call it prayer chain, but we see it as a fellowship. And it's been a real positive thing for the church.
I think we bring our experience in praying to the corporate example that we see in our congregations, where a prayer is offered and you know, it's got its parts and its requests and that sort of thing. So I think that's the example. And until you spend a lot of time trying to meditate that, to contemplate what satisfaction you can get from prayer, I don't think it occurs to you that you should meditate. And that's, it's interesting to hear you say that, because in the last few years that's occurred to me as well.
I'd like to hook that meditation aspect in with the vocational aspect, because there are a lot of things that I know that I had a gift to understand that I was called to do something. Many people have big question marks here. They kind of go, well, I'll go through life and whatever happens, happens. That didn't happen with me. I just happened to get pulled and yanked. With most people, that's not that way. Perhaps meditation is a good way of helping to come to a realization that maybe you are being called to something that is important in the redemptive work of the world. There should be some way in this, in our parishes, to help people come to that realization, to equip people with that.
I think it's extremely important also as the next step to not only to assist in people seeking the answer or God's answer to their life's vocation, but also as a reinforcement. The parish definitely has a job to do to reinforce those vocations that are chosen. And so often there's, I have felt in the public service work personally, that there are so very few people that really understand what I do that I feel really alone and out there on a limb just waiting for something to come along somehow.
I can relate to that. Yeah.
I'm wondering how we help our children to come to the point of meditating, because for me, it took me a long time before I could come to the point of listening, because if I listened, then it meant I might be committed to something. And I can see that in my children, that how do I get them to that point of wanting to listen, because there's something good out there for them, but yet, how do we help them to understand that? They have some talents and some gifts God's given them, but it's like a fear of, maybe this will be something I can't handle.
I think that's a commentary on our society, in a way of speaking, because a lot of our society is built around the concept that whatever feels good is the way to go. And our youth oftentimes get that loud and clear, good communication that way, especially through school, you know, and those kind of things, where whatever's good, feels good, go ahead and do it. And through the church, perhaps we have to spend more time helping our kids to understand that, or to come to a realization that a Christian community is more than the worship experience on Sunday, and then a fight to do something in Sunday school or not to do something in Sunday school. That's more than that. That it's a commitment to a lifestyle which proclaims Christ as Lord and rejoices every day that a person is alive in the fact that Christ is there, and that the church is God's arm in the world. Helping kids understand that and get serious about it isn't all that easy.
Yeah, I'm wondering how we help our kids.
I think we miss so much a chance, because when you're, you know, the youth, that's the people that are most moved by a challenge. And if we had some kind of programs where the kids were challenged, you know, it seemed like in my church, it's the all-night party and the pizza party and, you know, all that stuff that's nice, but it's not a challenge. If we could provide things like, you know, provide opportunities for kids to go on WAF teams, which is missions overseas, or Habitat for Humanity, or working in Portland, they have the Catholics have a program where their youth go and spend a whole week in the Bowery area and serve in the soup kitchens and actually get in contact with people in need instead of, and it's those kind of challenges. I think the teens would really respond to something where they had a chance to serve. But we don't give them a chance to serve. We just keep them busy with, you know, skating parties and that kind of thing.
It's probably because we're not down there serving in the soup kitchen.
Yeah, we don't like, you know.
And I think, I've thought this for a long time in our own congregation, that there's so many areas that people do not feel comfortable or they feel frightened they wouldn't do something right, you know, that we really need to walk each other hand, holding hands through situations. Myself, I'm a housewife, I don't consider that a vocation particularly. And so I have a lot of time to spend in applications, things I choose to do, and helping people find things that they can choose to do that are in these areas, in these active areas. And yet, I wouldn't feel comfortable doing certain things for the first time. And I've often thought that in our adult classes of Bible studies, maybe together with our youth, it would be interesting to embark on an adventure, a challenge, together, challenge each other to do some of these things. A lot of safety in numbers.
Well, I think that's a really important point. Woody Allen says 90% of courage is doing it the first time. You know, things don't look so bad, but there's another reason why it's particularly important, I think, for Lutherans, and that is that I think per capita we've got more introverts than you find in anywhere else. Somehow introverts just, it's like a magnet. And we need to help each other kind of overcome that corporate limitation that we have as being a little shy. And you know, you say taking people by the hand, that's good. But as you were saying too, finding ways of helping people to, you were suggesting young people, get out and have some of these experiences. That's great. It's particularly good if some adults will go with them. It's also good if some of the adults will go. Joel's program of taking people off to Latin America, for example, or the Middle East. You know, it's like Pharaoh. Or not Pharaoh, but Joseph, when he was working for the Pharaoh. You know, he heard stories about things happening. And he went and looked. And he saw. And as a result, persuaded Pharaoh to make some changes. Big changes. But there's nothing like going yourself and looking. There's nothing like learning languages either and being able to communicate with people. I think that's something that really ought to be emphasized in a parish. With all of the members to learn languages. You know, sign language is a part of it too. We've been exposed to here last week. But, yeah.
To piggyback on the session that just came before the Bible study about being open to the surprise, I've often thought that young people, children, and youth is one way we can receive a lot of grace and a lot of a challenge and kind of piggyback on their enthusiasm. And as a parent, I think sometimes we forget that we have something to receive from our children. We're not always here to just give to them and help them understand the world, but maybe they're there to help us understand the world. And this whole idea of opening up the idea of redeeming the redemptive work of all creation. What an exciting thing to get the future generation involved in. And also to help them feel empowered to do something.
Yeah. Now, let's see. Schramm, what's his first name?
John
Schramm. I think after he left Holden, I went to Washington and founded a parish there. Is it Lord of Life? Is that the name of it?
Community of Christ.
Community of Christ. Mm-hmm. Thank you. You may be able to tell the story better than I. But one of the things that has always really impressed me about that parish is that it has something called a dream fund. And part of its activity is to encourage people to think about what should you be doing with your life. And somebody will come up with an idea, get an understanding of their call, their mission at that point in their life. It involves doing something different. Maybe starting a soup kitchen, for example, or a child care facility. And it takes some money to do it. Well, they have part of their contributions go into what they call a dream fund. And it's a pot of money that's set aside to help members of the parish to accomplish a dream that they have, accomplish a mission. And if someone wants to get some money from the Dream Fund, there's a committee of the parish that is set up to help them. If somebody's going to set up a daycare center, they may put an accountant to work with them so that they do the financial part of it well, and it's planned well. They may has to be a building involved. They may put somebody that knows something about building there on that committee. But they try to put together a support group, a team, to see that the dream really comes about. And they give some money to the person, maybe several thousand dollars. And that person then goes ahead and tries to work out what the dream is. I think that's a wonderful kind of thing to do to help people. It's another place that I'm aware of where a member of the clergy is really trying to help people in this direction or choice of vocation. And in this case, it's a matter of changing vocation. There's a group of Christians, particularly Roman Catholics, working at a nuclear weapons production facility called Pentex in Texas. And many of them are feeling that's not their calling anymore. But they're there with kids in school, they've got mortgages, and there's no other job on the horizon. Now what do? Well, they keep building nuclear weapons, is what they do. And a bishop down there, his name escapes me at the moment, has set up a fund to help people make career changes, to get out of building nuclear weapons and go to something else. I think that's a really constructive thing to do.
You're a prophet, Jerry, in speaking in terms of open and honest critique of what the church, in its, at least its external appearance, has become. That's a very dangerous occupation. You could get stoned for that, you know.
Yep.
But it seems to me that it's the kind of refreshment that we all need. I'd like to use one simple illustration. I hope it's simple. Most of us go around from our youth thinking of sin. And if your training was as mine, that has normally meant violating some rule someplace. Later in my life, as I studied law, I realized that what people were talking about there was either a misdemeanor or a felony, usually, rather than being alienation from other people. Alienation from the world, alienation from God, that separation. It wasn't until I realized that that I realized what richness reconciliation means. being pulled back into a relationship rather than being pardoned from crime by the governor. It's that kind of simple look at our language that I think we need so badly, and you're pushing for, really, at least as I hear you. A man by the name of John Douglas Hall, I'm sure some of you have read his books, has written a book called God and Human Suffering. And in that, among other things, he calls our attention to the fact that sin in the traditional theology of the church was broken down into two parts. One being that body of wrong into which we are born. It exists before I even had time to rob a bank. The patterns of civilization had built up in a way which are inherently destructive of other people's welfare, just because they've built that way, because we live in a world in which there's been this accretion of traditions and patterns which are harmful to people. The other kind of sin is that built upon the judgments which I make in my life, for which I do have the responsibility of decision. Looking at the first kind, the kind that's, if I can even use this word without distorting the whole thinking process, traditionally called original sin, meaning that accumulation of pollution, that accumulation of lack of responsibility which has resulted in richness and poverty and the building of all of our institutions. The thing that Christ did and that you're asking us to do now is to speak responsibly to those existing patterns which are harmful and to be judgmental about them against the background that they are not loving. And therefore they ought to be changed, they ought to be reassessed. I think our churches have become what they've become because we always seek the most common denominator. As usually said, the least common denominator, that which will ruffle feathers the least. And we've lost the radical content of Christ's life. Very unsafe. I say, you're a prophet. And you're asking me to pray less. and I understand that in the context of what prayer has become in the common language of trivial speech rather than living a life of prayer where everything, that's very radical and it's very necessary and it's great that you're doing this. It's also very dangerous. Christ was killed because of that. And it isn't safe. And it seems to me that the Christian today is called to be a risk taker. Maybe not grammatically, but I think the Christian has to speak to the institution of the church in terms of re-evaluation of what we're doing, what we're not doing, in terms of reassessing the institutions which exist. Well, I said I'm trying to be short about it, but I mean that as a sincere compliment. To ask the questions that you're asking is the role of the prophet, and I think the church needs it today.
Well, let me respond simply by saying that I have seen some of these structures, as you call them, that lead to injustice. And have gone to my parish pastor and say, you know, what does the church have to say about this? Is the church doing anything about this? You know, what can be done? And more often than not, the answer has been, you know, wait a minute. You have to understand that this is an evil world, as you were describing. Even before you were born, there were aspects of the world were evil. There's the consequences to the third and fourth generation of all the sins and the injustices that have happened in the past. And that leads to a difficult kind of thing to deal with. Now, the reaction that I've often had from the clergy is, now, we don't get involved with that. What we're concerned with is saving souls, each individual one, one by one. And it is, as I've thought about it, as I've listened and meditated, it seems to me that the God I know is saying to us, that's not enough. And that part of the job is pretty simple anyway. You know, I helped you along quite a bit on Good Friday. But what I'm calling you to do is to be a part of the body of Christ rising, to be a part of redeeming the creation. And the God I know is saying there is a lot possible if we're willing simply to be brave enough to say no to some of the things that we know are injustice. We don't have to go on perpetuating to another third and fourth generation some of the injustices that are going on. And you know, the clergy keep telling me, well, it may not be possible for people to be good because they're corrupted by the sinful environment around them. Now, we may not be able to be perfect, but I think we can be better than we are. And whatever is possible, we should be moving in that direction. And there are two books of anthropological studies that have really made a strong impression on me. One is The Gentle Tacidae. This is a group of people, a very small tribe, I think about 23 people. It was discovered deep, deep in the rainforest in the Philippines. And they were Stone Age people. It was a tremendous shock to them when an outsider arrived because they thought they were the only people in the world. They had no idea there was anybody else but them in the world. And to find that there was another person was a tremendous shock. And they spoke a language which language specialists got to looking at the language and the words and the structure and what they were related to. And they concluded that those people had not had any contact with any other civilization, with any other people, for somewhere on the order of 2,000 to 3,000 years. You know, the total isolation from all others. Well, they also began looking at the practice of the people. And there was among those people a kind of love that I don't think that we have any concept of. They did not even have in their language a word for fighting. They didn't know what it was. It took a long time to try to explain this to them. The logging companies wanted to get in and cut that part of the rainforest where they were. And there was an effort on the part of Emmanuel Elizalde to get that part set aside as a national park and those people protected and a large amount of forest left around them. Loggers didn't like this, and so they hired some thugs to go in and shoot these people so that there wouldn't be any reason to preserve the land anymore. And when the thugs arrived with machine guns and rifles and everything, there was this big commotion. The Tassade came running to see what it was all about. They couldn't understand the possibility that somebody would want to harm somebody else. It was just so outside their framework. And the nature of those people and the description of them leads me to believe that it is possible for individuals and for societies to be far more loving than we've experienced. The other book that had really made an impression on me is a culture that's exactly kind of the opposite. It's called The Mountain People, written by Colin Turnbull. And it's a tribe of people that live on kind of the border between Kenya and Uganda. And they got pushed up into the mountains because They didn't wear as much clothing as we do, and the governments wanted tourists to come in there, and it was rather alarming to find people wandering around in loincloths and not being fully attired, and it was bad for tourism. So they got pushed up onto this mountainside, and where they'd been hunters and gatherers in the past, they were now asked to become farmers in land where no Iowa farmer was ever going to be able to grow anything there. It was terribly bad soil and just not appropriate at all. And the people got put into a situation of chronic near starvation. I mean, really very bad. And the life expectancies got very short. Typically, a lifetime would be on the order of 20 years. And after a period, a relatively short period of time, a generation or two, they lost all concepts of, that we, I think, would call human. It came to the point that the only occasion for laughter was to see another human being suffer. There's a story in the book of the great pride and joy that a mother had because of her daughters having contributed so much to the enjoyment of the tribe. The daughter was about 6 months old, and one night, sitting around the campfire, the daughter started crawling toward the fire, and all conversation stopped, and everybody watched as the child crawled closer and closer to the fire, and finally reached out and put her hand right in the coals. Nobody made anybody's effort to stop the child. And the child got burned badly and screamed. And when it was all over, the mother went and picked up the child, great smile on her face, as because she and her child had been able to bring such joy to the whole tribe, because this was an example of someone suffering. And another change was the only concept of good that survived was a person who had food. A good person was a person who had food. Children at age 3 were thrown out of the house, literally. You know, from 3 on, you're totally on your own to get your own food. The only reason people married anymore was that both the man and the woman had felt they had found a way to exploit the other. But in that society, there was one person who was left who was insane by the standards of this group, the Eek, they were called. It was a woman named Adupa. And Adupa died because she felt that parents were to love and that parents loved her. Adupa became very sick one time, and she was no longer able to stagger out into the forest and find a little bit of something to keep her alive. She went to her parents, who lived in this hut made of reeds. It was quite strong. She asked them to help her. They assured her that they would, and that they were going to go look for food. She lay down there and waited for them. They never came back. They never intended to come back. They simply went out and left her, and came back 3 or 4 days later and threw out her remains like a bunch of rotten garbage. She might have lived if she had not turned to her parents, but simply forced herself to go and look. But she died because she believed her parents loved her and would help her. And I think what we have to do is recognize that there's a world in which a lot of people don't understand love and wouldn't help us any more than Adupa's parents would. But even if we die, we have to go on and find a way to show love and to show our expectation that others are going to love. Now that's, I think, a key part of being a witnessing Christian today.
You bear with me for a couple more sentences. I would be untrue to my legal profession if I didn't come out in defense of the pastor at this point. So the right. Pastor is my client. it's easy to fault the clergymen in our congregations today for not dealing with the kinds of problems that you are discussing so well. I think one has to realize that we are fortunate in the Lutheran Church in having pastors probably several steps superior to almost any other clergyman. I'm overgeneralizing. Certainly much better than many pastors, because after all, at least they have been through college. They have received the theological training. And I believe they do understand what we're talking about. The difficulty, I believe, lies with us. My congregation is able to back a pastor in the corner awfully quickly if what the pastor is saying does not comply with our rather narrow interpretations of our traditional doctrines. And he's like your atomic scientist. The pastor also has a wife and child and has to eat. And it's much too easy for the pastor to accede to the unspoken but very clear demand of the congregation to be traditional and not to be radical. I don't appreciate it when my pastor tells me to get off my seat and out in the street, as the pastor is wont to do for the first couple months until we get tamed and housebroken. And I think that as congregations in the church, we've got to be very careful with our pastors. They're a very rare resource. I don't mean that you're unfairly criticizing them. As I say, it's just that I'll speak for my client here.
Fair enough.
I'm interested. What did the parish do for that deputy sheriff? It was without work, and because he felt he was right, he was doing the right thing, he didn't want to see anything wrong going on. What was the was the church behind him?
Well, I'll tell you the things that I know that the church did. The pastor spent a good bit of time with him, counseling him. And I invited him twice to come and tell his story to our forum group early on, and after he had been unemployed for 4 months or so, come back and talk again. Talk about the election campaign and what that had been like. I think there were some members of the parish who got involved in his campaign.